And good afternoon. Welcome to Vocal Point. This is Dr. Jerry Newcomb, and it is our privilege to have as a guest again Bill Federer. Bill Federer is a walking encyclopedia who's taken a lot of his encyclopedic knowledge and turned it into great books. And one of those books is called There Really Is a Santa Claus. And we're going to talk about Christmas traditions. And I tell you what, we're going to try and cram a lot in these first 30 minutes. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Jerry, great to be with you.
Okay, so what do you mean there really is a Santa Claus? You mean there really was a St. Nicholas?
Correct. Santa Claus is the Dutch pronunciation of St. Nicholas. So which starts off around 280 A.D. Now, this is still during the Roman Empire period of history, and there were 10 major persecutions of Christians in the first 300 years, and it was during this time that Nicholas was born in Patara, Asia Minor, which is today Turkey. And the he is to the Greek Orthodox Church what St. Peter is to the West, and what St. Patrick is to the Irish, and what St. Mark is to the Coptic Egyptians. In other words, St. Nicholas is the most popular Greek Orthodox saint. So they have lots of stories that they pass down. Some are more believable than others. But it starts off with around 280 A.D. He is born, and his parents are wealthy and elderly, and he's an only child. And so a plague sweeps through town, and he dies. His parents die. And so here is Nicholas as a young man having inherited a large amount of money. And so his uncle, who was in the ministry, encouraged him to serve the Lord. And so the story is that Nicholas would go into the town of Patara at night and help the poor and anonymously leave money because he wanted the glory to go to God, not to him. And one story was a merchant in the town of Patara had gone bankrupt. And back then, the creditors would come and not only take your house and lands, they would take your children. And sort of like the sex trafficking that goes on today, they talk about Brazil with the World Cup. They're having this, you know, 500,000 child prostitutes, you know, pushed. So this is a horrible tragedy that still continues, but it was there in Asia Minor. And so this merchant was bankrupt. And he had three beautiful daughters, and he knew if the creditors came and took them, they would probably end up in a life of prostitution. So the merchant had an idea. He thought if he could hurry up and marry his daughters off, the creditors would not be able to take them. Unfortunately, he did not have money for a dowry, which was needed in that area of the world for a legally recognized wedding.
And basically, it's still true.
Yes, and most of these countries, that's required for it to be legal. And Nicholas did not have Nicholas heard the merchant's dilemma. And so late one night, he throws a bag of money in the window of the merchant's house. Supposedly, it landed in a shoe or a stocking that was drying by the fireplace. It provided the dowry for the oldest daughter. She got married. It was a big buzz, talk of the town. He threw a bag of money in for the second daughter. And when he threw it in for the third daughter, the dad was expecting it, ran outside and caught him. And Nicholas made him promise not to tell where the money came from because he wanted the glory to go to God. And so this was the origin of the tradition of secret gift giving on the anniversary of Nicholas's death, which was December 6th of 343 A.D., and the midnight visits and the stocking by the fireplace and so forth. He goes on to have quite an eventful life. He was going to go into a monastery. There was this hyper-pietism that was sweeping the church at the time that if you really want to be holy, you got to go give away your money and live in a cave. Or the desert fathers in Egypt, where they would build platforms in the desert and climb on top and bake in the sun, thinking they were getting holier. And Nicholas went on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land with the intent of joining a monastery, but somehow the Lord told him not to hide his light under a bushel, and he decides to go back to Asia Minor, which is today Turkey. Gets off at a city called Myra. It was a large city, and unbeknownst to him, the bishop had just died, and the church leaders could not decide who the next bishop was to be. And Nicholas's habit was to fast all night and be the first one to church in the morning. Well, the church leaders were praying, and one elderly 70-year-old church leader had a dream that the first person to church the next morning would be named Nicholas, and he was to be their next bishop. So sure enough, he's waiting at the door. Nicholas walks in, tells him his name, and so they usher him into the room, and they say, you're supposed to be the bishop. Well, he was not too thrilled with the idea.
How old was he at the time about?
He was probably in his, you know, late 20s, early 30s.
Okay.
And the emperor was Diocletian, and he was killing bishops and killing church leaders. So it was not a really might have been flattering, but it was a dangerous thing. In other words, you be the bishop, and everybody else takes a step backwards,
Right, it'd be like the sheriff in the Wild Wild West in some of those towns.
Yeah, it would be like, taking on the ACLU and being on the front lines. Well, Diocletian, who was he? Well, as I mentioned, there were 10 major persecutions of Christians in the first 300 years, and the 10th was the worst. Diocletian had lost some battles with Persia, and he asked his generals why. And the generals said, "You've neglected the Roman gods." So Diocletian orders all the military to worship the Roman gods. Well, it had been about 25 years since the last persecution of Christians, and so there were a lot of them in the military, but they were forced out. Sort of like today, the Christians are being forced out of the military, saying they can't use the name of Jesus, they can't pray out loud, they can't, have their Bibles and proselytize. So we're seeing a de-Christianization of our military. Well, that's what happened with Diocletian. And once all the Christians were out of the Roman military, Diocletian decided to use the Roman military to force all of the Roman Empire to returning to worshiping the Roman gods. And he starts this systematic persecution that goes province by province, cutting out their tongues, boiling them alive, tearing down churches, burning the scriptures. He supposedly erected a monument to the extermination of Christianity. And it went on for 30 years. The emperor, Diocletian, is struck with an intestinal disease and steps down in 305 AD. The next emperor, Galerius, continues the persecution. He's struck with the intestinal disease and dies. Now there's no emperor. And the Roman soldiers pledged allegiance to their general, not to the flag, not to the republic, but to the general. And so when there was no emperor, the different armies would size up their generals and they would say, well, you be the next Caesar. And so there's four generals, and one of them is Constantine. He is in York, England, and his soldiers surround him and say, "Hail Caesar." And so he, with their support, marches toward Rome. And it's now boiled down to two generals, Maxentius and Constantine. And in 313 AD is the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, where Constantine, the night before, sees the sign of Christ in the sky. It's the first two letters of the Greek name for Christ.
Kairo.
It was the X, and then what looks like a P, but it's an R, and as you mentioned, it's the Kairo. It's the K sound and the R sound for Christ. And so he puts this on all of his shields and symbols, and he wins the battle. And so Constantine now legalizes Christianity, and this is when Nicholas is let out of jail, and he goes back to his town of Myra. And now that it's legal to be a Christian, he preaches against paganism. And so there was nearby a temple to Diana, and then at Ephesus was the big temple to Diana. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, 127 huge pillars and temple prostitutes. It was the Las Vegas of the Mediterranean, and Nicholas preaches against this sexual immorality. So he would have been a fire and brimstone type preacher today. And the people get stirred up and tear down the local temple to Diana and eventually tear down the great big one there at Ephesus. And then there's the Arian heresy. A guy named Arius said that Jesus was a little less than God, and so he writes a little song, and it's catchy, and the Visigoths, who had been a people group that came into Rome, they embraced Arianism, and it split not only the church, but the Roman Empire. So Constantine, who knows nothing about theology, orders all the bishops to go to Nicaea and settle this thing, and they do. They write the Nicene Creed, and the tradition is that Nicholas was so upset at Arius for starting this Arian heresy that Nicholas slapped him across the face on the floor of the conference. So jolly old St. Nick had a little temper there. You better watch out.
Let me just stop you real fast, because a lot of people are familiar with the book The Da Vinci Code, which claimed to have a factual backdrop, which is not true. I mean, in other words, it's the facts, so-called, are not facts. For example, he says that at that Nicene Council, that's when they decided to, say that Jesus was divine, and they voted on it, and it was a close vote at that. No. First of all, the Christians were worshiping Jesus as divine from the very first century through that time when the bishops voted on whether to adopt the Nicene Creed, which acknowledges Christ's deity. The vote only had two people voting against it, only two people voting for the Arian position. So it wasn't a close vote at all.
Well, and even the Arians believed he was divine. They just believed he was the first of the created beings.
There was a time when he was not, said Arius about Jesus.
Yeah, and so we believe in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and that nothing was made that was made without the Word. And so Christ would pre-existed his appearance on earth.
So how do we go from a man slapping, you know, an errant bishop, one bishop slapping another, how do we go from that to the big fat, you know, guy with the red suit?
Well, it's a fascinating story. He, again, is the most popular Greek Orthodox saint, so there are a lot of stories passed down. Some are more believable than others. One is a ship was passing through full of grain, and his people were starving, and so he goes down to the docks and talks some sailors into unloading the grain to feed his people, and he promises that God will bless them, and sure enough, on their return trip, they say the grain that was left multiplied, sort of like the little widow's meal barrel in Elijah's time.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was a storm, and the sailors couldn't get back, and they get Nicholas. He goes down and prays, and the sea becomes calm. And then a very famous story of a corrupt governor who was about to execute some soldiers to cover his corruption. They tell Nicholas, he rushes down there, breaks through the crowd, grabs the sword out of the executioner's hand, throws it down, turns to the corrupt governor, and reads his mail in front of everybody. And the governor realizes nobody could have known the details other than God. And so he begs Nicholas to pray for him, for God to have mercy on his soul. Anyway, Nicholas dies in 343 AD, and on December 6th. A century later, Justinian, the Roman emperor, builds a big cathedral, names it after Nicholas. In 988 AD, Vladimir the Great, the emperor of Russia, converts to Greek Orthodox Christianity, and he adopts Nicholas as the patron saint of Russia. And that's why so many people are named Nicholas or Nikolai, and churches are St. Nicholas churches. And then the Muslims invade in the year 1087. And they would destroy churches and dig up the bones of the Christian saints and give them to the dogs. And so as the Muslims were going through, again, what is today Turkey, all seven churches mentioned in the book of Revelation were destroyed by the Muslims. Ephesus, Colossae, Galatia were destroyed by the Muslims. And so the Christians took the bones of their famous Saint Nicholas and shipped them from Myra over to Italy, a little town called Bari, B-A-R-I, Bari, Italy. And they built a cathedral there. The Pope Urban oversaw it. And so we see that the destruction of churches still goes on today. Hundreds of churches have been destroyed by the Muslims in Syria, in Egypt, in Iraq, just within the last year or two in Nigeria. So as the Muslims invaded, they moved the boat. This would be like if Washington, D.C. was being invaded by jihadists and they were destroying, they were getting close to Mount Vernon, and they were going to trash the bones of George Washington. We'd have some people sneak up there and steal them and ship them down to Texas or something, you know. So here, Nicholas, it is the year 1087 A.D., and his bones are there in Bari, Italy, a big cathedral, and this introduces him to Western Europe, and all the gift-giving became very popular, so much so that St. Francis of Assisi sort of in protest came up with the nativity scene, the creche scene, saying, you know, all this gift-giving's fine, but it's a distraction for the reason for the season. Jesus was born in the manger.
And just so we say this, Francis is in the 1200s. What you described began in the 1087, so that's just before the 1100s. So it just kind of gives us a time frame. And for those who may have just joined us, we're talking right now with Bill Federer, AmericanMinute.com, and he is the author of many books, including There Really Is a Santa Claus, and he's making the point that all of this is thoroughly got Christian roots to it, and as Christians, it's exciting to kind of know these things because obviously the secular culture at large is big into Christmas, not realizing how much Jesus is really the story behind the story. But go ahead and continue. So now you brought us up to the 1200s with Francis of Assisi. Keep going.
And Christmas from the 3rd century on was on December 25th, and the formula that the church used was that Zacharias, the father of John the Baptist, was in the temple for what is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, which mm-hmm. would have been around September 25th.
Right.
And that means his wife Elizabeth was 6 months pregnant. It would have been March 25th when Mary visited her.
Okay.
And Mary was brand new pregnant. And so 9 months after March 25th, this is December 25th. That date was just a church service, but it began to get significance when Clovis, the king of the Franks, was baptized on Christmas Day in 496 A.D. And then the Council of Tours in 567 A.D., they couldn't decide which day was holier, December 25th or January 6th, the Epiphany, the three wise men.
Yeah.
So they made all 12 days from December 25th to January 6th, the 12 days of Christmas. On 800 A.D., Charlemagne was crowned the Holy Roman Emperor on Christmas Day, 800 A.D., mm-hmm. and then again
Napoleon?
Vladimir.
Oh.
But this is interesting. St. Stephen was crowned King of Hungary on Christmas Day in the year 1000. St. Stephen. Now, little trivia, St. Stephen had a son named Emmerich, and he was killed at 22 years old, but he was a pious young man, and so they called him St. Emmerich, and he was sort of popular. And his Italianized spelling of Emmerich was Amerigo. And that was the namesake for Amerigo Vespucci, who had a continent named after him, America. So America is named after Amerigo, which is the Italianized spelling of Emmerich, which is the son of St. Stephen of Hungary, who was crowned on Christmas Day in the year 1000.
These were Christian people.
Christians, all Christians.
Yeah.
And then, again, we're back up to the Muslims invading in 1087. His bones moved to Italy.
Nicholas.
Matter of fact, the tourism minister of Turkey sued to get the bones back in the year 2009. But we saw that by Martin Luther's time, 1517, he starts the Reformation.
Right.
He ends the saints' days. Every day of the year had at least one saint that would be acknowledged, and he thought this was somewhat of a distraction from Jesus. And then the biblical theme began to get a little bit changed. The idea was that Jesus would return to judge the world at the end of the world, riding a white horse, judge living and the dead. And the saints would be coming back with Jesus riding a white horse. And St. Nicholas is a saint, so he certainly would be one of those riding a white horse coming back with Jesus. And the Greeks just had St. Nicholas coming back once a year for a little mini judgment, a little checkup, right? And in Spain, they still have him coming in town every year dressed as a bishop riding a white horse. In Norway, they didn't have horses, and so he's riding it on a reindeer. Lamb's Book of Life and the Book of Works, that sort of turns into the Book of the Naughty and the Nice, and the angels turn into the elves, and the where do saints come from? Heaven, the celestial city, the New Jerusalem. Well, that turns into the North Pole. And so as these different changes began to take place, that's when Martin Luther said, you know, we need to go back to the reason for the season. Jesus was born in the manger. And so Martin Luther ends the Saints' Day acknowledgement in Germany and moves all the gift-giving to December 25th, which, again, had just been a church service. But now he said all the gifts come from the Christ child. And so the German pronunciation of Christ child is Christkind, like kindergarten and kindercare. And Christkind over the centuries got morphed into Kris Kringle. And so Kris Kringle is not young Santa Claus. No, he's the German pronunciation of Christ child. Martin Luther also put up a tree, put some candles in the branches, told his children this is like the sky above Bethlehem on the night of Christ's birth. But again, the focus was to get back onto Christ. And then we look at England. They had a little different experience. Henry VIII brought the Reformation to England, not because he had a spiritual experience, but because he wanted another wife. Ended up having six wives.
Yeah, you know why? You know why he wanted another wife? He wanted a son. That was the real goal. And his wives were, they weren't having sons, basically. And that's why he was divorcing one after another and killing others and so forth. But how does Henry VIII fit into Christmas?
Well, during his time, Had some advisors that said, if you really want to break with Rome, stop using the Latin Bible, get an English Bible. He spreads the English Bible around the country, and people began to read it and wanted to purify the Church of England, and so they were nicknamed the Puritans. So now we have the Anglican Church with the king at the top, and then the Puritans who are inside of the Anglican Church wanting to purify it and get it closer to the Bible. Now, with that dynamic, Henry VIII, he made Christmas in England a party time. You know, it had carousing and drinking and partying, and he brought back an old Roman holiday, Saturnalia, and Saturn was the god of feasting and plenty and merriment. And if you've ever seen the Christmas Carol with Charles Dickens,
sure,
there's the spirit of Christmas present. And you're looking at this guy, he's got green robes, wreath in his hair, the whole, whole happy party guy,
yeah.
And you're looking at him and asking yourself, who is he? He sort of looks like Santa Claus, and he sort of looks like a Greek god. Well, that was Saturn, but they Christianized him and called him Father Christmas. They couldn't call him Saint Nicholas because saints were outlawed now. But again, during this time, Christmas became sort of a Mardi Gras. And now, what is Mardi Gras? Mardi Gras is the day before Lent when you would fast for 40 days before Easter. It originally was a spiritual day. Now it's this lewd party in New Orleans. That's sort of what happened in England. And so the Puritans in England would write things like, can God be honored by mad mirth and hard drinking in a party fit for a Bacchus or a Mohammedan Ramadan? Certainly the King of Heaven cannot be honored by this. And so during this time, the Pilgrims and then the Puritans leave England and settle America. And the Pilgrims did not observe Christmas. Again, they said the Sabbath was their holy day and all the other days were the same.
Mm-hmm.
Another boatload of Pilgrims came over, and they wanted to celebrate Christmas. And William Bradford said, since we are not into forcing conscience, until you're further educated, we'll let you. And on Christmas Day, the rest of them are working, and they come back and see the second boatload of people are playing the stickball in the street and stuff. And William Bradford says, it may offend your conscience to have to work on Christmas, but it offends ours that you're playing while we're working. So if you're going to observe it, do it quietly in your homes. The Puritans that settled, Boston and Salem, they actually had a 5-shilling fine for anybody caught celebrating Christmas. Again, the Sabbath was the holy day and all the rest were the same. In England, there was a civil war and the Puritans won. And for 15 years, the Puritans outlawed Christmas in England. And anyway, it was not until the Dutch settled New Amsterdam that they did bring over their St. Nicholas traditions, and the largest church in Manhattan Island was St. Nicholas's Dutch Reformed Church at 48th and 5th, and it was there up until just last century when the church leaders, the attendance was dwindling. They sold this big, beautiful building to be torn down, and they built an oil company building on the corner.
Oh.
But nevertheless, it was in New York that Washington Irving, who was the U.S. minister to Spain.
We have about 5 minutes left, by the way, Bill. 5 minutes. So please wrap it all up. But go ahead. This is excellent.
Well, Washington Irving wrote Dietrich Knickerbocker's History of New York. And in there, he says, now St. Nicholas visits us once a year, riding in his wagon over the treetops, throwing out presents to his favorites. But he describes him no longer as a bishop, which he still is over in Holland, but describes him wearing a Dutch outfit of long trunk hose, stocking hat, leather belt, and boots. Well, also in New York in the early 1800s is Clement Moore. He was an Anglican Hebrew professor, and he wrote a poem for his children, A Visit from St. Nicholas. By the way, the Dutch, they added a little element to it. St. Nicholas would come once a year with presents, and he had a little helper with him called Zwarte Piet. And Zwarte Piet was a Moor, a Muslim from Spain, and they would tell the kids, if you're good, you get presents. If you're naughty, Zwarte Piet will put you in a gunny sack and take you back to Spain and sell you into Muslim slavery. Muslims enslaved over 1 million Europeans. There were entire Catholic orders in Europe during the Middle Ages called Trinitarians, and the head of the order was called the Ransomer, and they would collect alms and donations and go under a white flag to North Africa to get your friend back.
Okay, so back to Santa Claus.
So anyway, I was doing a radio interview and someone called in and said, yeah, I was raised over in that area of Europe, and every Christmas Eve, all the little boys would make sure to have pocket knives in their pockets. I said, why is that? He goes, that's to cut ourselves out of the gunny sack in case Svarte Pete took us.
Oh, man.
Anyway, but in New York, Clement Moore, a Hebrew professor in this Dutch colony, now it's a British colony, he writes the poem for his children, A Visit from St. Nicholas. So he's still called St. Nicholas, but now he's a right jolly plump old elf. I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself, a broad little face and a round little belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. The stump of a pipe yelled tight in his teeth, and the smoke had encircled his head like a wreath. And said, wait a second, when did he take up tobacco? I mean, that came from the American Indians. But nevertheless, he sort of shrunk in size. And then we get to the Civil War. And Thomas Nast is the illustrator who, for Harper's Weekly magazine, that gave us the Republican elephant and the Democrat mule. And Thomas Nast is the first one to put a North Pole sign behind a picture of St. Nicholas. And this was a political jab at the South during the Civil War to claim that St. Nicholas belongs to the North. Anyway, also Thomas Nast does a colored version for McLaughlin Brothers, and he's the first one to paint the outfit red. Before then, it was just fur. And then finally, you get up to Coca-Cola in the 1930s, and Coca-Cola invented mass marketing. It's the best-known trademark name in the world, and they had Haddon Sundblom, an artist, do a painting for 30 years, one every year, of Santa Claus, St. Nicholas. Again, Santa Claus is the Dutch pronunciation of St. Nicholas, Sant Niklaus, Santa Claus. And so Haddon Sundblom, Coca-Cola, does a picture of St. Nicholas drinking Coke. And this is spread around the world, and this is the image that sticks. He's now full-grown size again, no longer the little plump old elf, and rosy cheeks, ruddy complexion, a nice huggable grandfather-y looking person. And but we remember that if you go back to the beginning and peel away all the traditions, you get back to the 4th century, to the real Saint Nicholas, who loved Jesus so much he was imprisoned under the Roman emperors. He stood up for Bible doctrine and the Trinity at the Council of Nicaea. And he was generous and gave to the poor and did it anonymously. And so when we peel it away, there's a genuine godly Christian man that we can remember at this time.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for being with us. I guess we still have about a minute or so left. So is there any other major tradition that you may have left out? Any aspect of this? That points back to Christ.
I did a book. It's called There Really Is a Santa Claus, The History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Traditions. AmericanMinute.com is my website. And I also have things that happened on Christmas throughout history, like Christopher Columbus's ship, the Santa Maria, ran aground on Haiti on Christmas Eve, 1492. George Washington crosses the Delaware River on Christmas Day evening of 1776. Captain Cook discovers the largest atoll in the Pacific, Christmas Island, in 1777. Wow. And I even come up to George Patton right before Christmas in 1944, has his chaplain, James O'Neill, compose a prayer, prints it on a quarter of a million index cards with Patton's Christmas greeting to his troops on the flip side. And they all pray it, the sky clears, and the next day, Patton's Third Army is able to come to the rescue of the 101st Airborne. So there's a great Christmas tradition, and FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, at this time says, we will celebrate Christmas in our traditional American way because the teachings of Christ are fundamental in our lives, the story of the coming of the immortal Prince of Peace.
Well, you know, Bill, you're an American treasure. You really are. Thank you so much for bringing all this to light, and let me be one of the first to wish you God bless you and Merry Christmas to you, Bill.
Well, Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
Thank you so much. Bill Federer, AmericanMinute.com. We'll be back in a moment with more Vocal Point.